Is it important that we're recording? Yes.
Well,
Yes.
then you
And
better. Well, I mean,
we are recording. That's all right.
okay,
Okay.
good. Off we go.
All right. John is going to make a little introduction.
Oh, yeah, here goes. I'm one of the keepers of this thread on waterways that we are running currently in politics and letters. And so this afternoon, Bruce Robbins, the editor of Politics and Letters, will be interviewing Tom Krusa. And let me start with an introduction. Up to now, the focus of the posts on our waterways thread has been the aesthetic, the environmental, the social richness of actual waterways. Their largely unseen presence in the built landscape of our urban and suburban worlds, their dramatic role in linking global spaces, and their tremendous imaginative power. The ways in which they fascinate us and shape our construction of personal histories and larger destinies. The turbulent politics of waterways has always been implicit in these posts, but in today's, on the water war of 2000 in Cochabamba, Bolivia, the politics become explicit. Cochabamba was by no means, of course, the first water war, hot or cold. Such wars had been fought since time immemorial, whether over wells in the desert or irrigation and grazing rights or geopolitical matters, or the Bosphorus, or the control of entire cities, seas, or oceans. And they've been fought here as well in the US, as the film Chinatown, set in the LA of the 1930s, reminds us. But over the last 30 years or so, vast forces, climate change, explosive population growth, and neoliberal strategies of water exploitation have brought endemic tensions to the point of crisis all around the world. Back in 1994, Robert Kaplan broke the news of this new generation of water wars in an Atlantic essay called The Coming Anarchy. Military planners and educators, he reported, were already training military elites to fight the inevitable resource wars of the 21st century. And in 1995, Ismail Seregaldin, an eminent Egyptian public intellectual and vice president of the World Bank for development, environmental development, famously declared that if the wars of this century, the 20th century, were fought over oil, the wars of the next century will be fought over water, unless we change our approach to managing this precious and vital resource. Only months later, the Cochabamba Water War, dubbed by some the first water war of the 21st century, broke out in Bolivia. Focused precisely on issues of physical, political, and economic water management, it pitted popular movements from the city, the unincorporated periphery, and the countryside against the Bolivian government, multinational organizations and corporations, and the Bolivian police and military. Fierce and increasingly massive confrontations rocked the city for weeks, and in the end, shots were fired, people were injured, and one protester died. Tom Krusa, who was there, produced a brilliantly trenchant and comprehensive account of the struggle and the forces that set it in motion. La Guerra del Agua en Cochabamba, Bolivia. Terrenos complejos, convergencias nuevas. He's here today to talk about the water wars of Cochabamba. Bruce?
So, Tom, what the hell were you doing in Cochabamba back then in 1999?
Raising children, some social science research, a little bit of solidarity work back and forth between the United States, and consuming local water and watching when the bills started to go through the roof. I was also at the time, specifically when this arose, working on a labor project that was a combination of research, the changing worlds of work and why unionization and labor was so hard, labor power was declining. And also practice. We were looking at, you know, how do you actually organize unions in the informal sector? So that's what I was doing at the time. And it kind of positioned me in an interesting place, because one of the key leaders of the struggle against water privatization was precisely one of these labor leaders, a guy named Oscar Oliveira, whose name is familiar to a lot of people.
You ended up working for the government of Evo Morales. And if I understood correctly from a little bit of research, kind of superficial research, I'm afraid, the happy ending of this story, or at least provisional happy ending of this story, helped propel Evo Morales into office. You weren't at this point already involved in the movement that brought him into power, right?
Well, I think I wouldn't cast it as sort of a mechanical thing, you know, like this thing was capitalized on and turned to, you know, electoral advantage in some clear way. But the rebellions and the pushback against, you know, many years of deracinated neoliberalism in Bolivia, you know, were bubbling up in many different ways. And the person who was able to turn that to political advantage eventually was Evo Morales. But it came from further, and it was more than just one person. And I'll also say, though, that Evo Morales at that time was a leader of the Confederation of Coca Producers Unions in the lowlands of Cochabamba region. And he came to the city with a lot of his organized rural producers in the coca regions and helped with the blockade. So he was also active. And I have actually photographs of him on the ground in Cochabamba on his cell phone talking to the groups that he was helping to mobilize. So he wasn't apart from it, but nor was there a clear mechanical through line.
Shift the terrain a little, Tom, and ask you just as a point of departure, whether you could draw us a picture of the actual waterways of Cochabamba, the city and the region, just before the war broke out in late 99, early 2000.
Right, so Cochabamba is the Interandean Valleys. Bolivia is marked by, you know, highlands, Interandean Valleys, and then Amazon lowlands. Mm-hmm. And this valley, the Cochabamba Valley in particular, is sort of the breadbasket of Bolivia, famous for producing the grains and fruits and vegetables that were then shipped up to the mines or other labor enclaves that sustained extractive economies century after century. And it was, you know, wildly fertile, and there was an abundance of water. I have postcards from the 1920s and 1930s of rivers spilling over their banks. And, you know, it looks like a paradise in terms of, you know, verdant and humid. By the time I moved there, though, a lot of that water had already been drying up for a number of reasons. Some changes in weather patterns. How tightly that's connected to climate change is something I don't know, but it was raining less, and the draw on water had grown enormously between both people tapping underground reservoirs and, you know, sucking up that water and dropping the water table levels, and increasing demand in adjacent rural areas. So those images of the rivers running full and even spilling over their banks were only a distant memory. So what you need to imagine is it's also like so many Latin American cities, it had grown, you know, willy-nilly and very quickly. And through economic crises, people had left the mines and moved to places, you know, the big poor neighborhoods that are absorbing people from all over the country with poor services, getting dustier, drier, you know, the economies of makeshifts that are at the peripheries of major sort of primate cities, as they call them in Latin America. That's the Cochabamba you sort of need to call to mind.
Yeah.
And it was a thirsty city. Water was, you know, expensive, especially for those who could afford it least.
So speaking about the economies of makeshift, one gets a sense looking at water systems then and now in Cochabamba of real ingenuity, but also real shortages and real deprivation. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right. And I wish I had a number on the top of my head to tell you, you know, what percentage of the urban population of Cochabamba actually had access to the formal water system. But it was no more than two-thirds, right? There was at least a third, or if not more, who were buying water off of trucks and filling up repurposed 55-gallon barrels.
Right.
Organized on a community level to dig a well, put in a pump, distribute water in the local neighborhood, and create their own little systems that were more or less regulated and connected to the not connected physically, but connected to the sort of regulatory apparatuses. So you had an amazing patchwork of people just buying water directly from aguateros, you know, water sellers. Yeah. You had little communities, and then you had the pretty decrepit formal water system, which I called a vast underground irrigation system because it was so leaky. For every, you know, I don't remember what the number was again, but for every 10 gallons you put in one end, only five made it to anybody's tap.
Right. Was there also a tension between the agricultural surround and the cities in terms of who got the water and how?
Yes. Famous tensions. And in years past, before the water war that we're talking about today, water struggles had emerged and shaped as city versus countryside.
Uh-huh.
Right? One of the remarkable things about this water war is that the way in which water was privatized, it actually created a common interest against the privatizers between city and countryside, overcoming this historic, you know, the people who were historically at odds with one another. So were there? Yes, because surface water was used by rural producers. That meant that the water tables were not being as recharged as fast, or other surface related sources were no longer accessible to people in the city. The city was drying up more. Mm-hmm. And that's also what gave rise to these fantasies of bringing, you know, doing pharaonic scale projects of perforating mountains and bringing water down into the valley from, you know, miles away and thousands of feet above the valley.
Right. So you were getting an image then of a kind of both of abundance and of a kind of chronic tension between potential human users of water. So what tipped the balance and turned the, you know, chronic tension into outright struggle?
Well, simply put, gosh, this might sound like a bumper sticker, but let's just say neoliberalism.
Right.
Bolivia was facing a period where it had been a good pupil in the sort of post-structural adjustment school of neoliberalism. It had gone through, you know, getting the prices right, delimiting the role of government properly, creating markets, creating free trade agreements. They had gone through all of the Washington consensus policy prescriptions, and they were moving into the third phase, which was the privatizations, which is the hardest part, because Bolivians actually, you know, well, they went through a national revolution in the 1950s, which led to the nationalization of key sectors, and people and their sense of, you know, the nation were very much wrapped up in some of these public industries. And so privatization was an attack on that patrimony, right? Shared patrimony on the one hand. And specifically when it came to water, it was one of the conditions of loan agreements between the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, to get loans to help manage a critical debt situation. They basically said, you want more money from us, you want liquidity, you want us to support your budget, then we're going to see changes. And one of those changes is we want to see privatization of water. And we want to see that rationalized and put over private management, under private management. Mm-hmm. And so that, the one detail on this, to manage a private water system profitably, you got to control not only, I mean, you have to control a watershed, and you have to control infrastructure, and you have to be able to price it, right? And you need a regulator to lock all that in. You have to have an effective monopoly, right? Mm-hmm. And this monopoly encroached on consumers' pocketbooks, because the prices, you know, you have to recover the price. It encroached on rural areas who had their own ways, culturally, historically, customary, to manage water. And so by imprinting one way to do this, you were pissing off people right and left.
Yeah. Is there a prehistory of privatization that allowed them to imagine that popular resistance would be weak and ineffectual? I'm thinking now of the closing of the mines and the breaking up of the great miners unions, for example.
Yeah, sure. There were those, at the level of ideas and historical experience, the word privatization came with a lot of opprobrium. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It comes with pain. And there was a natural resistance to it. But in addition to the insult, this was injurious. Injury was coming.
Right.
And, rural peoples around Cochabamba have as many words for water as Eskimos do for snowflakes.
Yeah.
As related to water works, waterways, and the ways in which water is controlled, whether the water that you're receiving is at the beginning of waters that are being released, the middle of the waters that are being released, or the tail end of the release, right? And there's a different word for each one of those, right? Yeah. So this is culture. And all of a sudden, you're saying you no longer control this. You're running up against all of that, right? And then in the city, the cost. I want to say one other thing about the privatization is that the World Bank very, very explicitly said that the water will be managed so that it fully recovers its costs. In other words, you have to sell water at a price sufficient, the business model, to sustain both capital investment and maintenance of the system. In other words, you can't cross-subsidize with other sectors of the economy. Which is a way of telling people you don't control your public budget, because if we decide that we're going to use money or taxes raised on value added taxes in one part of the economy and put it into providing access to water, which is critical for health, education, what have you, that ought to be our sovereign right. But here's the World Bank saying you shall manage this such that it pays for itself,
right.
And that essentially guaranteed, number one, the effective monopolization of this myriad of forms of water, which is just going to anger people at the governance level. And at the financial level, it means you're going to be sticking people with huge water bills. Mm-hmm. Now, you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to look at that and say, that doesn't look like a very good business model.
Right. Can I just say something which is a little bit less a matter of economics, but crystallizes things a little bit more? The World Bank was saying to the people who were going to have to pay for the water so that the loans could, make their money back. If you don't have enough money to pay for your water, die. Because water is this special kind of thing. If you don't have it, you can't live, right? So they were sort of saying, just go die, just, anyway.
In the last instance, that's kind of right. But in the day-to-day, it's if you want water, forego buying shoes or school supplies or any kind of, diversion that involves transport, right?
Right.
That's the immediate, that's between Tuesday and Wednesday. That's what was happening in people's lives.